This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Before there was The Daily Show, before The Onion, before Saturday Night Live, there was Mad Magazine. Since 1952, in one form or another, it has skewered politicians and popular culture through brilliant parodies, satire, and features like Spy vs. Spy and the Back Page Fold-In. Along the way, Mad Magazine has excited and corrupted the minds of millions of children, including mine, and now it turns 60. Mad Magazine has come out with an anthology, Totally Mad, 60 Years of Humor, Satire, Stupidity, and Stupidity. Nick Meglin's a former editor of Mad Magazine. He's going to be signing books at Barnes & Noble in Cary on Sunday at 4 o'clock. But first, he returns to our studios. Nick Meglin, such a pleasure to have you back here on The State of Things. How are you doing?
Okay, Frank. It's always a joy to be here.
60 years old. Mad 60, that makes you, what, 140?
Well, give or take 2 years.
Tell us about what does it say that Mad Magazine, surviving all of this, is still relevant at this time?
It doesn't say much to the intelligence of the country, I'll tell you that. Well, we've always been surprised along the way because we just had fun doing what we were doing. Bill Gaines, who was the publisher and who gave us the complete freedom to do anything we wanted. And it started with Harvey Kurtzman, who created Mad Magazine. You know, it was a comic book for 10 years, for 3 years. But the first 24 issues were comic book.
Well, tell us about that. Tell us about the origins of Mad and Harvey Kurtzman.
Sure. Harvey Kurtzman was just one of the brilliant visual humorists, one of the best ever. And he had done this comic book because he had needed to do more work to get more money from Bill Gaines, who was the cheapest man that ever lived. A living contradiction. Very, very generous in some ways. We'll get into that maybe. But as far as that, he said, look, we pay by the work. If you want to do another magazine to get more money as an editor, then do whatever you want. So you always had a sense of humor. Let's try a humor magazine. Now, this came from EC Comics, which was producing the Tales of the Crypt, The Vault of Horror, Weird Science Fantasy with the Ray Bradbury adaptations. Wonderful, wonderful, famous comic book work in the 50s. And so he came up with this Mad Magazine, Mad Comics, excuse me, which was a satire of other comics. And then it began to be a satire of other things like radio shows that were popular and TV shows from Howdy Doody, The Lone Ranger, whatever. And it grew. And then came the Comics Code and the big problem with Dr. Frederick Wortham, who believed that there was a direct line drawn between juvenile delinquency and comic books. So there was a whole investigation. It wasn't a congressional meeting, but there was some... Right. Kafafa, who ran as vice president in one election, was in charge of this committee. And they decided it had to be censored, and the comic publishing industry decided to censor itself. Mm. And as a result, they practically killed comics because you couldn't show a war comic couldn't show anybody getting shot. You know, a Western, you couldn't show a gun being fired. And the young girls with very innocent and very benign love magazines, they couldn't even show a couple kissing. So the story ended with them holding hands. I mean, you know, right. Naturally nobody stopped. So Mad Comics made it.
So did they censor themselves? Because eventually, I mean, Mad starts out not as Mad Magazine, right? But tales that will make you mad, right?
Exactly. And what happened was, to avoid that comic censorship, they became a magazine. In 1955, it was, I think, issue number 23 or 24. I forget which. You know, 60 years, you start to forget things. As a matter of fact, who are you? Oh. In any case, as the magazine flourished as a magazine under Harvey Kurtzman, and he wrote all of the comics and the comic books themselves, and then he wrote about 90% of the magazine. But then he went on to do another magazine that lasted only 2 issues for Hugh Hefner. It was going to be like in between Mad Magazine and Playboy, you know, kind of a rascally, slick magazine, and it was called Trump. Lasted only 2 issues, and then he went on to Humbug and then Help. So Harvey went on his own separate ways, and then we just continued doing what he had done as a magazine.
What was some of the early material? Once it became a magazine, what was that early material like?
Well, again, it was satires of movies and television shows and the culture and some political things. The big problem about doing politics, I think Matt has gotten a lot more credit for being this great voice in the wilderness, but we weren't. It was the McCarthy time and also the after effects of McCarthy, even after the downfall of McCarthy. It was still a rather repressed situation about a lot of subjects. And Mad did what it could within the framework of good taste, if you will, that we were allowed. And I think we were given more credit for being a political voice than we were, because we never really went after a party. We went after the man in the office. Mm. And usually, like in all satire, satire, you know, doesn't create. Satire reflects on something. And all we were doing was reflecting what was being done by the man in the office.
And you had some pretty impressive writers at the time. Woody Allen, you know, Ernie Kovacs. Who are some of the other writers?
Oh, Henry Morgan, Steve Allen, Danny Kaye. I mean, we had major one of my favorites was the great radio people, which was you know them?
I'm not that old. I started in radio long after it began.
Okay, well, then I'm going to tell you. In any case, yeah, we had great celebrity writers, but that was really to get their names on the cover. They didn't do a bulk of work for us. It was the great writers that we had, Larry Siegel, Frank Jacobs, Arnie Kogan, Dick DiBartolo, and, you know, that's the people that made it happen.
But you'd have to say that what made Mad Magazine, the trademark, that made magazine the icon that it is, had to be Mort Zucker.
Mort Zucker is definitely one of the three major icons, four major icons, five major. The artwork, all the artists. Mort Zucker was a phenomenal caricaturist.
When did Mort Zucker start with the magazine? Was he there from the beginning?
No. As a matter of fact, he came in at about the same time that I started working there as an editor.
That was about when?
1956.
All right, so that's and it starts out, its earliest incarnation is 52, so 4 years in or so, right?
Yeah, and only 2 years as a magazine, actually. And Mort gave us the kinds of likenesses that made the movie and TV satires work, because sometimes a caricature of John Wayne or Ronald Reagan looked more like them than the photographs would, and that's what helped us. And the other mad icons were Don Martin, who was the greatest, and then Al Jaffe and his folding pages, and we had and Sergio Aragonés, who does those marvelous little pantomime gags all over the magazine.
Still there,
you know, still pounding away.
Well, that's the other thing, was the endurance. You and they all stayed for several decades and made this, not only made the magazine, but kept it going.
Well, you know something, the editors like myself and John Ficarra and the people there now, Dave Croata, Joe Riola, Charlie Cadu, Jacob Lambert, everyone started, that we didn't have an editor that didn't come as a writer. And that helps it, because we wear the two hats that enable us to do that. And some of the people are also artists, you know, art educated. Sam Viviano is one of our major artists, but he's also the art director of the magazine. So all of these things help the visual with the writing, because that's what makes us different than every other magazine. We don't print text, you know, we don't do prose. It's not the written word, it's the drawn word, if you will.
Right. What drove the magazine? Did you start with the artist and say, all right, let's see where their talents are and that's the magazine? Or?
Well, that's the contradiction of the magazine itself, because it's really a thinking person's magazine. You've got to know what's going on to be able to get the satire to begin with. You know, that's why we couldn't do foreign films in the old days. Everyone would say, hey, Ingmar Bergman, Federico Fellini, when are you going to do satires? We say, who's going to see the original? Yeah. They wouldn't know the joke. With that in mind, it starts with the writing, and then it becomes the interpreter. I think it's much like a performance. I mean, Laurence Olivier's Hamlet was different than John Gielgud's Hamlet. And, you know, it's an interpretation, and each of the artists gave it their own spin with their own style. And we had the best artists in the country doing the best art writing, you know, illustrating the best writing in the country. I think it was a marvelous marriage.
Talked about Bill Gaines, who was the publisher at the time. He has an interesting story, as well as does his father.
Yes, his father created comics to begin with, the Famous Funnies, which in effect was just a reprint of Sunday pages. People who didn't get that comic section in a small town was able to buy the comic book that had those comic book features, and that developed then into interesting stories. And Bill Gaines always lived with another contradiction. He's a living contradiction. He was the cheapest, generous man in the world, and his father wrote, not wrote, but printed picture stories from the Bible.
Wow.
And Bill Gaines then did Tales from the Crypt, which is exactly.
Yeah. And Bill Gaines had to take over from pretty quickly. He wasn't expecting to take
over. That's exactly right. He was a chemistry teacher, and his father died in a horrible accident on the lake, just died, and Bill had a mother and sisters to support. So he took over the father's industry and company and built up EC Comics. It began as educational comics, and Mad was anything but educational when it ended up.
I don't think that's right. I think Mad has educated a whole generation of thinkers and actors and performers out there. I mean, list the people who you know who attribute a lot of what they do today to having been Mad.
That's phenomenal. I mean, some of the highlights that we've lived through is one night we were working later on a deadline and a knock on the door. And at 6 o'clock, we says, "Who's this?" The office has been closed. Reception is gone. Nobody there. I go out and I open the door, and there's Robert De Niro standing there with his 14-year-old son Raphael. And he said, "I hope you don't mind, but we live in this neighborhood, and my son here loves Mad, and I thought we could drop up. You know, I'm going to say no. You can't come in, right? You say no to the Godfather, right?" So there we were, and his son was shown all the original artwork. He was in his glory, and we chatted with Robert De Niro, who's the nicest, shyest man in the world. And that Carol Burnett did the same thing. Showed up with one of her daughters one afternoon, unannounced. You know, they're just big Mad fans. But I think the biggest Mad fan. Two of the biggest Mad fans are George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. They began with Mad, you know, and always were fans. As a matter of fact, between them, they bought the original artwork of every cover that we did a satire of any of their movies. If you see them all framed in their office, executive office, you see the Star Wars, you see Indiana Jones covers. But let me tell you a little anecdote about that. It really happened where after we did Star Wars and Mort Drucker's magnificent, brilliant caricatures of the Star Wars characters and a brilliant script, everything was fine. And we get a letter about 3 weeks later after it was published from the legal office of George Lucas Company. And they wrote us a cease and desist, take all those articles off, and we're going to be sued for the whatever, you know, $1 million and for... And Bill Gaines didn't flinch. He said, "Here, make a Xerox copy of this letter." And then just he wrote a note on it. We made a Xerox copy, and he sent the letter to them. He had written the letter came from George Lucas and saying, "Hey, that satire was better than the movie. I wish I, you know, had followed your scenario." And a wonderful, wonderful. So Bill Gaines wrote on the top, "Funny, sirs, George liked it," and he put it in an envelope, sent it back. We never heard from him again.
So he sends Lucas' fan letter to the lawyers, and that's the end of that lawsuit. But there was another lawsuit that was actually a landmark, and it's a critical free speech lawsuit that Mad was involved in.
It's written into law, and it's a marvelous one because it protects satire under the First Amendment. What happened was we did a songbook, printing lyrics for very popular songs of Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, and the major writers of the day, and with the popular songs of the day, or older. And what happened was the songbook was a freebie put out in an annual magazine. We did annual magazines for those who missed issues of old things, and we'd always put in a free bonus, some kind of thing, a calendar or something or other. And we did a songbook this time. And Irving Berlin sued us. And when they measured his lawsuit, it would have come out to about $25 million if he had won this lawsuit.
Wow.
And again, we weren't too concerned because it was we never printed the music, so it was just satires that suggested could be sung to blue skies, for instance. And we did Frank Jacobs wrote Blue Cross, and it, you know, Blue Cross had us agree to a big Blue Cross policy and then picked out all the flaws of Blue Cross.
Right.
So it's total satire, had nothing to do with the original, but we didn't print the music. So they really had nothing to stand on because it wasn't unfair usage. We weren't using their product. And when it got to the Court of Appeals right before the Supreme Court, it got to the Supreme Court, but they dismissed it. They went on the Court of Appeals. But the judge was very brilliant, and he says, hey, Mr. Berlin, you cannot copyright pentamic.
I am the pentameter.
and he said, also, if you were to win this case, then anybody who sang, you know, Easter Parade in the shower would have to send you 2 cents. You know, you can't control someone's mind because we're saying can be sung to the tune of that's your mind's eye,
right,
if you will.
That's an important case. How about some people? I mean, obviously, if De Niro shows up in your office, he liked his characterizations. Were there people who weren't flattered and were angry, even if they didn't sue and let you know it?
Well, angry, yes. Anyone who took themselves seriously, like some politicians, really thought we were the enemy. And because we were exposing, obviously, the flaws and frailties of whatever their position was or whatever they had said. By the way, that's probably the most difficult thing to do in satirize politics today because the politicians themselves beat us to it.
Yeah, right.
I mean, how do you make it funnier than what they've already done?
Right.
But that said, by the way, Bill Clinton was a big mad man, really. I think that says a lot.
Yeah.
What happened is,
Just saying that anybody come screaming in your office, you said mostly politicians and people to take themselves too seriously.
Yeah, they don't like what we do and why we do it.
Yeah.
But, of course, these are the people who say that, you know, America is a democracy and are the first to want to make it a dictatorship with censorship.
So tell us what's in this 60th anniversary Mad Magazine book now.
Well, what it is when we realized we had hit 60 – and certain landmarks along the way. For instance, we're in the Smithsonian. I mean, Mad is in the Smithsonian, my God. Also, they placed an issue in a time capsule. There's been a time capsule planted with a Mad magazine because when it gets picked up, they wanted to, whatever future people, you know, the aliens, whoever are taking over the Earth at that time will...
They've already done it, I think, Nick. Actually, it's happened.
Yeah. Yes. Well, what's happened is the 60 years of Mad is a surprise to all of us because we keep doing what's fresh and out there.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem like 60 years have passed that we've been commenting on the society and on the culture at the time, but it has.
And Mad has a web presence as well, doesn't it?
Yes, we've had to go on the web. You know, this is an unfortunate thing that we find that sales in all reading matter is down, whether it's books, magazines, newspapers. And Mad has felt that, too. We're a different kind of magazine because we're an illustrated magazine. But still, in all, the young people are brought up in an electronic age. And, you know, everything is done with buttons rather than reading. And people don't even read for the entertainment or the education of it. Mm. And my son's an English teacher, and, you know, getting young people to read the classics is almost impossible. What do you do? And that makes it difficult for us. Satire is based on foreknowledge. You know, you got to know what it is. You got to see, this happened. I was dating a school teacher many years ago at the time, and she said that a sad thing happened in her class. She was teaching an advanced high school class, senior high school class, advanced English. And she made a reference and she mentioned it, that was like the same thing as a great white whale. And a hand goes up in the back. And this very bright young man who had already been admitted to Harvard or Yale or whatever said, I hate to correct you, but it was a great white shark, not a whale.
Ooh.
And she said, she scratched the headset, and then she realized he's thinking Jaws. And then she said, how many of you have ever heard of Herman Melville? Not a hand went up. How many have ever read or know about Moby Dick? Not a hand went up. Advanced English high school.
Luckily, we've all heard of Mad. 60 years old. Nick Meglin, what a great pleasure to have you on the program.
My pleasure, Frank.
Nick Meglin, former editor of Mad Magazine. He's going to be signing copies of Totally Mad, 60 Years of Humor, Satire, Stupidity, and Stupidity at Barnes & Noble in Cary this Sunday at 4 o'clock. Coming up, the tight harmonies and hard-driving rhythms of the South Carolina broadcasters. Stay tuned.